You're listening to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast from Misadventures of an Adoptive Dad.
Well, hello, Scott. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. Very well indeed. It's a bit of an unusual podcast because it's an interview with Sue Armstrong Brown, your boss.
My boss. Yeah.
So you can dish the dirt. Is she a good boss?
I think that's a very unfair
question. No, don't answer that question.
It's not difficult, actually. I think it's one of those kind of conflicts, hence the reason I didn't help you with the interview, I think.
I didn't even ask you.
No. And sometimes these things have to be done. So when I interview your bosses about you, having known her now for, I think it's 5 months.
That long?
Yeah, I think it is, actually.
It's April, isn't it?
Yeah. And kind of the differences and between kind of Sue and Hugh, oh, it rhymes. It's different, but it's all the same. So I'd be interested to hear what she's got to say.
It's still early days, isn't it, for her?
Of course it is. Yeah.
You've listened to the interview, haven't you? So
I have. Yeah. I was impressed, actually.
Yes. I mean, you'd get a lot of questions. I was surprised how many questions you got, and some of them were quite pointy questions. That's how I interpreted them. Twitter's not good.
Yeah. No, it's not. But I think that similarly to some of the other podcasts that we've done, where we've asked these questions on Twitter, I think actually you covered it off quite well in the interview that, Adoption UK is a charity that's been set up to originally was set up to try and influence and also support adopters, and it still has those values, but we don't, Adoption UK doesn't change laws and policies and all that sort of stuff. We just try and influence. So I think that's important.
That was a little bit of a funny bit of the interview where she doesn't want to downplay the influence we do have, but I guess neither overplay it, because and I think it was the first time I ever realised the kind of the lobbying role. I know that sounds really stupid, but I realised the extent of that lobbying role, and actually it gave me a renewed reason why to support Adoption UK, because it's not just supporting adopters, it's about the process and the system.
It really isn't. Yeah, exactly. And I think that, there's lots of organisations out there, some smaller, some the same size, some, medium size, that all do the same thing. I think that these days it's more about the collaborative kind of sense of working together. So, that actually a larger organization can represent. But as always, it comes with the kind of political kind of bits about whether you agree with, this, that, and the next thing. And at the end of the day, we all just want to make the world a better place for the children. Yes, of course we do. So why would we not just want to, all try and work together in some way, shape, or form?
Yeah, but I think adoption still, there is an element of friction even within the adoption community about how best to achieve those aims and goals. And I think that I see across Twitter different people who take a different stance. We have activists, we've talked about it before, activists, people who are less activist, and people who are quite passive and kind of just happy to get on with it. That's fine. What are you doing? You're making a cup of tea.
No, I've got the creature from the Black Lagoon is sitting eating his breakfast. Oh. I was just asking if I'm making a cup of tea. Yeah, you are that noisy.
Oh, well, it's nice to see that the humdrum routine of your domestic life is goes on regardless.
I know.
It's good. There he is. With no more ado, I think we'll listen to some interesting stuff there, and then maybe we can be interesting to see what people thought of it. It'd be interesting to get some feedback from people.
Yeah, definitely.
I did try and ask all the questions. I tried to kind of condense them, and I put names to them where I could. I had a big list. So here we go.
This week I am speaking to Sue Armstrong Brown, who is the new Chief Executive of Adoption UK. So, hello, Sue. How are you?
Very well, Al. Thank you very much for taking time to talk to me.
I think it's probably more reflects me badgering you and me twisting your arm. And I'm aware that you've probably got lots of people who want to speak to you and want to ask you questions and those sort of things. So thank you for giving me the time.
Your pleasure.
Now, I just mentioned before, I asked the question on Twitter yesterday, the day before. I said, hey, I'm interviewing Sue Armstrong Brown, new CEO of Adoption UK. Anybody got any questions or topics? And literally just it took over my stream and people had all kinds of questions. But I don't really want to get to them yet because I think it's not fair. And some of them are really specific. And I think that's, you know, I'm not sure that that helps. And some of them were questions about things that were nothing to do with you. And I thought that's, you know, people obviously have you in very high estimation. But I want to start at the beginning, and which is, why did you take the job?
Why did I take the job? Well, I didn't intend to take the job at all. I'd been working for charities. I spent my career working for charities, and it's where my heart lies. But I actually had intended to freelance for 4 years after I adopted my daughter. That was my plan. So I'd set myself up as a freelancer. I started to get work. I was enjoying it very much. I had a lot more flexibility and I was at home with her. And then this job came up. Cool. And I had to apply for it. It just absolutely landed in the middle of all my plans as something I was, as soon as I hadn't known that I wanted it. And as soon as I read it, I thought I absolutely want that job.
So why did you want it?
Why did I want it? Because it is doing what I want to do, which is helping charities to speak up for the people they represent and to influence decision makers for the better. So it plays on all my experience. I spent 20 years working to get to this place. And it's an adoption, which is my passion. I'm an adoptive mother. I just brought this child into my family after years and years of waiting. And there it all came together in this one job. So I did actually tell the trustees at the interview that they had advertised it 4 years too early and that was very annoying for me. But this was the moment when it was here and I wanted to go for it.
So all the ducks were in a row, so it seemed just an opportunity too good to miss, really.
Absolutely, yes. That's how it felt.
I have utmost admiration for you because I think adopters are peculiarly stroppy bunch of people. My question before that is that historically, Adoption UK has always been led by someone who's got experience, personal experience of adoption, and then it wasn't. So was there a strong desire by the trustees to kind of bring it back to that, someone who's got a lived experience?
Well, I think the trustees would be able to talk to that better than I could. They've appointed me and I'm an adopter, but I don't think they would have appointed me if I'd just been an adopter. To run a charity is a professional job. And actually, above all, you want someone in any charitable job who has got the professional experience to deliver against the objectives, which is very nerdy of me to say. I don't think you need to be an adopter to do this job. I think that being an adopter, personally speaking, helps me to be as good as I can be in this role. And that's because I'm one of those people who only has a very blurry line between professional and private interests. Yeah. If I'm interested in it, then I'm interested in it. If I care about it, then I care about it. And whether or not I care about it at work or at home is secondary to that. So for me personally, being an adopter is very helpful. And one thing I have absolutely noticed is since coming into this role, I've been really impressed by the level of energy in the adoptive community, the number of people who want to come forward and talk to me and colleagues about what Adoption UK can do to help adoptive families. That's just come over absolutely loud and clear. And it's very clear that I don't think this is necessarily the case for everybody who has adopted, but for many people, it feels like the entry into a community. And they want to speak for that community and help that community. And it isn't limited just to their own family. There's a sense of kinship with other adopters that's really striking.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, I totally think that the roots of the charity, you know, a few people sitting around a kitchen table can do a lot. But actually, the context that Adoption UK is in now is a very different financial context, political context, legal context for adoption. And so you're absolutely right. You know, people jokingly were kind of, when the job came up, going, oh, you should do this. And I was going, I have no idea. Honestly, most people I've ever been in charge of was two. And one of them was like 16. So I think you've got, you're obviously bringing a unique set of skills. And what do you think that you've touched on your experience? What elements of your previous experience do you think you're going to draw on to push forward the Adoption UK agenda?
Well, I'm actually now thinking about offering you a job share to come and help me do this.
You've got to be kidding, honestly.
You can help organise people who are 16 and under. Oh. Actually, I say organise, there's no organisation involved whatsoever. The team here are organising me, which is as it should be. The experience that I was able to offer the organisation is that of helping charities to get decision makers to listen to them and get the evidence that's available in the community to the fore, so that policymakers in particular can take that on board when they're thinking about decisions that they've got to make. If they don't know, or if it's not presented to them in a way that's easy to understand and use, mm-hmm. all that experience can have no impact. So I've spent 20 years helping charities get their point of view over to decision makers. So that's one area of experience I've got. I've also worked on supporting delivery teams get things done, and on just policy development and the ideas generation side, where, you know, it's all very well sort of saying, here's a problem, banging the drum, providing evidence that there is a problem. But unless there's a solution that goes with it, it's so much harder for anybody to do anything about it.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been working on. I actually started life as an environmental scientist, so nothing to do with adoption or child development or anything like that. But it did school me very, very well in getting information and evidence organised so that other people can understand what you're trying to say.
Right.
There is a little bit of a tendency for a mantra that goes, you won't understand unless you're an adopter too. To sometimes come out.
Yeah, that's interesting you've seen that.
And while that's true to some extent, that, you know, only other adopters, not only other adopters, but mainly other adopters will have some common experiences, it's not a good place to start if you want to change the wider system so that all adoptive families can benefit. It needs to be, I'm an adopter and I can help you, who may be a non-adopter or maybe an adopter or may have all sorts of family experiences. I can help you to find something in this that you too can understand and care about.
Do you think that's a problem
for you to help?
Yeah. Do you think that's a problem within the way some of us adopters communicate, that we're fighting so strongly from our corner that we don't necessarily see the benefits of what we're saying for a greater community of children and parents?
I think that a lot of people are absolutely on their knees and have to fight for their own families and have to get that one solution that they're after. And that's their priority and needs to be. And I wouldn't for a second suggest that they should put their energies anywhere else, because that's what they should be doing and want to be doing until they've got some improvement that they're after. But that particular approach also needs to be complemented by some other things that will come in and put the wider context on, so that they're not a series of case studies, so that it's a bigger picture that's coming over, so that if, say, a minister or a civil servant or somebody is trying to sort of sort out their top priorities that they need to act on, an adoptive issue comes to the top of that list. It's not one person or one struggle. It's a community, and it's a community who have taken on the country's most vulnerable children, and there are some common needs and they need to be addressed. And we've got some suggestions about how that could happen. And that way of talking about the same subjects can help get decision makers to understand what we're up against and what they can do to help.
Well, that's interesting, because I think, like you say, you can sit in a room and an individual can be dismissed because that's your experience. But if you broaden it out, then there's a weight behind your voice, isn't there?
Well, that's exactly it. I always remember a fantastic scientist who I used to work with saying, the trouble with case studies is they're all just gossip.
Yeah.
And not convincing. And that, while I think all of us as humans are very convinced by an individual story, and that, you know, you if you've got an ounce of empathy and you hear some of the stories we hear about from adoptive families, you're drawn into it and you start thinking about it. But if you're trying to balance that with a bunch of other similar stories, how do you know which one is the one that you need to pay most attention to? And that's where Adoption UK can come in, because we can, you know, there's all of our members that they're, you know, these stories are the stories of the organisation, and we can sift them and bring out the common elements of them and say, it's not one person, it's not one story. This is happening to 80% of our members are saying that adoption's a massive, education is a massive issue, for example. It's not one person and one child. It's most adopters in the country. And, you know, that's the extra thing that we can add to those stories that makes them travel more.
This is starting to sound like an extended job interview, isn't it, now?
Oh, God.
I'm rerunning probably what all the things that you were asked when you were sat before the trustees and they grilled you. So I'll try not to do that. But my next
Although
question...
Although they didn't have such a jaunty hat as you, I'd have felt a lot less nervous for the interview panel had worn that.
Well, it's a new hat. It cost me £4.99. It was the cheapest hat I could find. But my other one was... anyway, we don't want to talk about my hats. My flamboyant hats. Hot topics. Right, so you've come and you've taken up, I suppose there's an element of you have to maintain what's been going on. You can't just come in on your first morning and go, right, everything's rubbish. Just clear the decks. Come into my office. I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. So you have to maintain an element of what's going on. But what do you see are the hot topics that you would like to run with as the head of Adoption UK?
Oh, there's quite a lot of hot topics. And some of them are, as you say, ones that are already being fantastically delivered by the team here. So the invention of Adopter Voice across England, I think is it brings to life the idea that the organisation can bear witness to the experiences of adopters and use that to make sense of decisions that are coming down. So for those who don't know, Adopter Voice is a way of bringing adopters together in particular places so that they can talk to local authorities and to other bits of the adoption system and say, this is what's happening here, this is what we need, this is how we've found it to be. And it's a lightning conductor for adopter experience to get straight to the heart of decisions and information and help the service to evolve far more effectively. So that's something that I think is a superb development and needs to continue and strengthen and roll out further. A really clear priority for me is that across the UK, England is the only country that has a dedicated post-adoption support fund. And we have lots of things to say about how that's run, but the fact that it exists is absolutely superb and doesn't exist in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. So I think that addressing that need for some dedicated post-adoption support across the UK is a high priority. Now, it doesn't need to look exactly like the Adoption Support Fund in England does, but there does need to be some extra support in the other three countries.
That's interesting because there's a lot of people who've adopted from England and live in Wales and all in Wales and live in England. And it was one of the topics that came up. The people said, actually, there's a genuine sense of injustice that people have access that others don't. And do you think that's there's a clear case for that, but does that make it into a quite a complex legal or policy issue? Is that likely?
It's certainly a policy issue. We need to work out how we take this forward. And the teams in, we have teams in, well, Scotland and Northern Ireland who are already working on, and they have been before I got here, I can't claim any credit for this, work on the need for post-adoption support to be available to adopters. And I think the argument will go, it is available. It's available through all the normal channels. And our argument would be, yes, and that's great. But we are talking about a group of people who are highly vulnerable with some common issues, and you know you're going to need to address them. So making some dedicated funding available so that it's easier and quicker to provide that support is what we're asking for. And that will become eventually a policy decision.
Yeah,
but that is something that we need to map ahead, because I think that the need is absolutely clear.
Sticking on the Adoption Support Fund, and wonderfully segued by me, I have to say, blow my own trumpet, was that some people were talking about the Adoption Support Fund and this ongoing challenge that they have, local authority to local authority, how it's implemented, how it's accessed, and people sort of asking for a duty. They want the duty. You know, they want adopters to self-refer or the local authority to hold the money. Do you think the Adoption Support Fund works as it is, or what would you change about it? If you could snap your fingers, change something, what would you change about it? Blue sky thinking,
questions. A very big question, very quick, very big. I do think it's far better than not having it, so it's definitely an improvement.
That's the right answer.
So I'm not going to diss it, but we can certainly see that there are limitations to it and it could work better. The administrative barriers are far too high. It needs to be much easier for families in need. They're in need right now. They're not in need in 3 months when the admin sorts itself out. Yeah. So So easier, quicker access and the things that need to be put in place. So that we know some local authorities are doing this extremely well.
Yeah.
Others are not. So, you know, getting us over that hurdle and getting it to be less of a postcode lottery for access is something that needs to happen. There's a conversation to be had around the fair access limit. So we can understand that with a limited pot, there needs to be some mechanism to make sure that, you know, it's shared out fairly yeah. well. But we can also see that in some cases that limit is too low, that the assessment points to multiple severe needs, which are, they can blow that allocation out of the water in terms of what it costs to provide. And we know that it's also skewing the market a bit with people having different behaviours, like trying to find cheap therapies to stretch out their allocation yeah. or avoiding the simple things that you can put in place, like peer support. Because they think they might need to save that money for the specialist therapy. You know, there's a whole lot of things, which means that people's decisions are skewed because it exists. So I think there's quite a lot more to do to develop that.
And it feels to me, because I've been on the adoption support EAG, that actually there's a lot of, there remains a lot of confusion in adopters' heads about what it can serve for, how it's accessed, who's got the money, what's the duty to assess. And then you look at some local authorities who are doing fantastically well and taking not a lot of money and spreading it really far to develop their support that they can give. And others that are kind of just seeing it as a band-aid to just go, oh, that's broke. Adoption support fund will fix that. And not exactly. and stepping over their own duty.
So there's two things around this that I think need to, over the medium term, need to improve. One is early intervention. So one of the reasons why the fund effectively run, you know, the families exceed their allocations is that they're not getting support earlier. They're getting it when problems have got really big. So moving to earlier interventions when people, there's quite a lot of stories out there of people who've asked for help, not got it, screamed for help, got it, by which time, you know, the job is so much bigger, the child is so much older, the behaviours have got really difficult, the child's more traumatised and so on.
Yeah.
So getting that early intervention, and that's a presumption, that needs a mind shift in policy from here's the money if you need it to, you're probably going to need some sort of support because you're taking on a traumatised child, we're going to work with you every step of the way so that you get it immediately.
On the outset.
And it sounds like a nuance, but it's a fundamental difference.
Yeah.
So it's not to say it's not good to have a support fund, but it needs to be used. The presumption needs to be it will be used and it will be used early rather than it's there for if you need it. So that's one thing. The other one is expert provision. So making it easier for people to get the help that they need. So you don't have to necessarily, I mean, you may be in the hands of a fantastic local authority team who are really quick and able to get to that expert assessment really rapidly and get you into the right channels, but you may not. And in that case, people receiving the wrong therapy or not getting it aimed at the right level, that then also wastes the money and doesn't help the family. So getting those two things sorted out over the long term, I think, are what we need for the adoption support fund. And that's not even mentioning the question of the overall budget. So on a practical level, of course, governments have to budget. They have to allocate a certain amount of money and then they have to make sure it stretches over what it needs to stretch. But we need to be in a different conversation, really, than have you spent your £5,000? It needs to be what is the deal that the state makes with an adoptive family when they take on a child?
Yeah.
And how is that going to recognise the circumstances under which the child has come to be adopted? And if we move to that point, we're less in the field of here's your annual allocation and more in the this is an ongoing lifetime of support. We're talking about sometimes it may be more, sometimes it may be quite a lot less. Hopefully it'll be more at the start and be less over time. But that kind of mindset where it's a different contract. Andrew Christie, the chair of the Adoptive Leadership Board, talks
friend
about
the show.
Contract with the state. I beg your pardon?
He's a friend of the show.
Very wise and very good with his words, and talks about the changing contract between the state and adopters. And I think that's exactly the right frame to be thinking about the development of the adoption support funding.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. And with the ASF as well, people sort of would, one of the questions from Penny Carey on Twitter was, you know, one of the challenges that many people are experiencing is people who've got children who are slightly older, 16 plus, really hard to access. And, you know, anyone who's kind of outside of the standard family unit or that family, that age group of child are struggling. Is that something that you've heard or been told, or is that on your agenda?
Well, the older children.
Yeah.
What about?
Well, it was just in people sort of saying it was difficult to access the fund for older children. Is that something that's been? I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot because I know you know, I've got so many questions, and each one of them can be quite specific.
I can't comment on the relative difficulties of different age of children to access the funds.
Yeah.
What I would say is that it is widely known that teens face particular problems. Non-adopted teens face particular sets of problems and challenges, and they get more and more difficult as our world evolves. Adopted teens face all those and then a lot more about identity. So there is certainly a case for arguing that these children should be receiving much more tailored support, almost as a matter of course. So I can't really talk about specific obstacles that particular person or other parents of teens have faced accessing those specific funds through those specific local authorities. It really wouldn't be my place to do so. But what I can do is say that these problems are, you know, they're understood at Adoption UK. We can see them happening. What I would say is what solutions would be from the point of view of the families who are raising these points, apart from a magic wand, what would be helpful? What would be most helpful? Because that's the sort of information that I think is very useful in shaping the conversation going forward. I don't really think there's very many easy answers.
No, I mean, there are as many answers as there are children. And it is, I am aware that I'm asking you really specific questions, but there is the next hot topic. Now, I'm giving you a hot topic, I'm not asking, is education.
Indeed.
Tell me what your thoughts on education, because I got a few questions people asking around the idea of an automatic education healthcare plan for adopted children, or an automatic a PEP meeting, personal educational plan meeting, which is what looked after children get as a matter of course.
So that schools is one of those lenses where that children seem to pass through, where suddenly they stop being looked after children, they just become children. So adopted children just go back to being children. And some of that extra care falls away, and we're seeing it over and over again. And this is one of the most important things that are raised through the membership with us. So we do have our schools campaign, which is aiming to work with schools to make them more attachment aware. And there's some very good work going on elsewhere as well. This does feel like a topic that's coming up the agenda, and it is sort of gradually achieving a bit more cut through. But we also know that schools are absolutely, you know, under the cosh budget-wise, they've got umpteen priorities. Yeah. They may only have one or two adopted children. What I'd like to say to them is that those one or two adoptive children can buy you a whole load of information and training for your staff on attachment that will then benefit not just the adopted children, but more than 60% of your pupils will have some kind of problem, some kind of attachment issue, something in their lives that has, you know, bereavement, divorce, upset, anything like that.
Yeah,
you don't have to be adopted to benefit from attachment aware teaching. Mm-hmm. So schools who are in England receiving the Pupil Premium Plus for their adopted children can choose to invest that in a way that really benefits those children and a whole load of others. If that doesn't rocket it up the priority list for schools, then I don't know what else I can say that would. This will really help them if they can access the information that we provide or that other organisations can provide. And I think following on from that, there are some specific policy improvements. You've mentioned a couple. There's using the Ofsted inspections to check what use is being made of the Pupil Premium Plus. There is including attachment training in teacher training syllabuses and as a CPD point for all staff in schools. You know, there's a number of things we could see that could help.
Yeah.
But the fundamental to all of it is increasing attachment awareness in schools.
Yeah. So I presume, sorry to be pick up on semantics, when you say attachment, meaning trauma and loss and
developmental trauma, all that,
the whole shebang.
And you're absolutely right to pull me up on that, because I do, and I've said this before, I think that attachment itself is a language barrier. If you hear the word attachment, you don't really know we're talking about these sorts of developmental trauma problems, because it doesn't tell you. So if anyone out there's got an idea for a better label, I think we're due one that would make it easier to understand what this is really all about.
I think that we've got a certain validity with the attachment word, and I think people are accepting of it, and we kind of piggyback into schools. I do training sometimes in the schools, and I know that the only reason they let me in is because everyone feels warm and fluffy about adopted children. But my first slide is, yes, but, like you said, you know, something like 1 in 20 children experience sexual abuse throughout their lifetime. 1 in 5 children live in domestic violence. And all of a sudden, you can see people, light bulbs going on, and then forgetting about adopted children, but just seeing children who experience trauma, which is really beneficial. They were talking about me, not you anymore, so that's no good. Rubbish interview. Right, my next topic. I mean, schools, back to schools. Schools is always going to be in the top three, isn't it? You're never going to... It's such a contentious issue, such a point of conflict and challenge and transition for the children and families. You're never going to get rid of it, are you?
No, and it's school. I mean, schools, there's a reason why so many of Enid Blyton's books are set in schools. It's the first adventure a child has outside the home, usually. As in the school of adoption, anytime you say anything, you have to say usually. But you know, that's the child going out, having an identity of their own outside the home, forming their own relationships with peers, making their own achievements without a parent. Of course, it's going to be absolutely huge, and it'll bring to life all the transition challenges and problems and issues of identity that a child's going to have. So it will remain a very important subject forever. What I would like to see happening, though, is, as well as the greater understanding of developmental trauma and attachment issues embedded throughout schools. I completely lost the thread of what I was going to say there. Yes, there are some other policy gaps. So the presumption that mainstream school is the only route needs to be challenged. At the moment, people whose children have trouble in school and where the school isn't able to address the way in which the problems manifest sufficiently to control behaviour, those children quite often end up falling out of school. We've got so many stories. Like every week, a new member talks to me about a child who's had repeat exclusions or been permanently excluded, or has been taken out of school because of the risk of exclusion, and they're ending up homeschooling. Now that's just a cliff edge. And while we know how dedicated adoptive parents are, and lots of them are changing their career plans themselves and homeschooling and doing all sorts of things, actually that's not acceptable. And while taking on board the things we were talking about just earlier around increasing attachment awareness in schools will help to a tremendous degree, there may well still be a proportion of children whose early experiences just mean they will never be able to cope in mainstream school. Yeah. Well, there needs to be better alternatives for those people. I don't think most parents adopt with the idea that their career will be shot down in flames and they're going to end up having to educate their child at home. Now, some people may want to do that, and that's great. Yeah. But if that wasn't their plan, that shouldn't be their only alternative. So we want to highlight that gap, that policy provision gap in education, where a child can't continue in mainstream school. What else can they do? What else is there for them?
Is an alternative
put in place.
And I'm increasingly seeing for one of my children that actually surviving school is the key issue. And you can get your GCSEs at any age, literally. Yeah. It's the survival of the system. Because, you know, I went back to school. I'm a mature learner. I did access English course in my 30s. So it's for many of those families, and I speak to, they kind of say, we just want to survive. We just want to survive without our child falling into a kind of a penal education system or a system of exclusion that socially is just harmful to them. So actually, can we just find a nice thing to do? Can we, you know, go and cut the grass for 5 years?
But what an extraordinary choice to feel people have, survive or not survive. I mean, that's...
It's pretty rubbish, isn't it?
Such a low aspiration. And it shouldn't be where people feel forced to aim. I think there's a lot to be done here.
I have to say, when I said it to the teacher, they weren't impressed. But I wasn't bothered. So, hey, life's short. Right, now I want to another one. The first person to answer me, and who answered me quite passionately when I asked the question, was Hannah Meadows. And you probably, if you on Twitter or anywhere socially media, you'll know Hannah Meadows. And she's banging a few drums. She said, when are we going to see a campaign for a national agreed response to child-on-parent violence?
A national agreed response to child-on-parent violence?
That's a question, isn't it?
Does it need to be a campaign? This is probably something I ought to ask her, not you.
I'll answer on her behalf. That's fine.
And a response from whom? I just want to be sure I understand the question before I start expressing any opinions about it.
I guess in some ways it's a very specific question, so that's not fair. But it's an issue that I think has not come out of nowhere, but it's actually turned itself into those three letters, pretty much everyone knows what they mean now. Whereas this time last year, maybe not so, and 5 years ago, definitely not so. But with still very few solutions. So is it something that's on your list of hot topics? I'm writing this, I'm going as well.
It's definitely. I mean, those of you who read Adoption Today will have seen that the August issue, it's got a whole big chunk of the middle dedicated to aggressive behaviour, coping strategies, things that people wish they knew, things that have worked, the different stages. It's absolutely on the radar. I suppose the thing I was querying was the specifics embedded in that question, that the solution might be in a campaign. To me, at least part of the job needs to be in terms of equipping parents to recognise that this is something that could happen. There's a debate around the name. Is it the right name again? There's a language thing there, and I'm sure you've talked about this before as well. But this kind of trauma-triggered rage behaviour comes from somewhere. There are things that can be done to help parents to know beforehand that this is a risk and to equip them, because the stories that come in a lot are that this seems to come out of the blue and it's absolutely traumatizing for the parents.
Yeah.
So giving them some more skills to cope and more tools and more abilities to recognize what could happen and strategies to deploy earlier before they're absolutely in the thick of it. We need to do that. So that needs to be a bigger part of post-adoption support and arguably part of the adoption preparation as well. And then it's not just parents, is it? It's not child on parent violence, it's child on anyone who's triggered it violence.
Yeah.
Or on things, the child can express their rage towards objects rather than people. It's all part of that trauma trigger. So then some better help for the children is the other part of it. So tools for the parents, help for the children. It all comes from recognising what it is and trying to find out as much as possible what are the situations in which this can be triggered.
I think it's a really difficult subject to even... I feel like I have put you on the spot in the sense that the reality is there's so many questions, and that's, we're at the stage of asking those questions, even feeling able to ask those questions about the implications of family systems on children, parents' response, parents' expectations, how they influence children's behaviour, and not victim blaming, but you've got to be able to ask those questions. So I feel that's probably an unfair question.
I don't think it's unfair because it's such an important issue. And if it's reassuring, I'm not feeling put on the spot. I'm just not sure that a national campaign is the only way to progress it. I mean, this is such a difficult area because it strikes right at the heart of our perception of adoption as, I'm saying, I'm not saying adoptive families, the national story about adoption is a child that has no family is given a family. And, that's a nurturing story.
A warm, fluffy feelings.
And there's no room in that concept for a violent, rage-fueled child that feels the need to defend themselves against the world by attacking it first. My dad used to say, retaliate first. That was one of his sayings. And that's kind of what's happening, isn't it? A child is feeling like they need to get in the first blow.
It's a strategy for controlling their world, isn't it? Making sense of their world.
So there is no sense in it, and it's what happens. And it is very difficult. I'll only feel put on the spot if you say I need to know the answer, the solution to it all, which
crazy.
I really don't.
No.
Certainly better tools for parents, better knowledge from professionals, and better therapy for the children who are in the sort of eye of this horrible storm are the things that we need to progress with.
I could talk to the nth degree about it because it's a world I've immersed myself in for years. Yeah. So I should probably speak to Hannah Meadows myself. Because there's stuff going on all the time around that. Right, any other hot topics? Maybe another one, FASD. Some people are asking about that and how that's kind of a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, how that's an emerging knowledge, a bit like CPV, in that 10 years ago, three people knew. All of a sudden, people are all asking the questions. Is that something that your members are asking about in relation to support and knowledge and experience?
Yes, it comes up a lot. I think this is one of the Adopt a Voice success stories, was that a group, one of the local groups of Adopt a Voice, raised that fetal alcohol syndrome was a huge issue for them, and there was no information available from the local authority, who subsequently went on to provide better training and information about it. So it's an example of the power of giving voice to adopters' experience, having an impact on decisions. So yes, it is, and it's a deeply frustrating one as well, because this is one of the areas that's been understood for a long time, the impact of alcohol during pregnancy on the development of the baby, and yet we're still seeing children coming through affected by it. We're still seeing parents finding out or suspecting that their children have fetal alcohol syndrome, mm-hmm. when it hadn't been necessarily known at the point of adoption, or at least not told them. It's an enormous problem, and it's a lifelong condition. So finding ways through for it, you know, it can be quite depressing as well for people who are in the situation where their child, they suspect or is diagnosed to have it, because there you're not going to change that now. That the damage has been done, and it's a question of living with it and finding the strategies to help.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a really emotive issue, and I think that even getting a diagnosis is still, it's a postcode lottery, and it's down to professionals. I was thinking about a lot of what we've discussed actually comes back to education, in the sense of us educating professionals. So is that is the thread through it all, really, isn't it? As I've looked, as I've been writing, as you've said, the hot topics, I've actually. Is that a lobbying role of Adoption UK to meet those professionals where they're at and say, you need to know about this, or you need to think differently?
Yes, part of the reason Adoption UK exists is to bear witness to the experience of adopters and bring it to the attention of those who need to know, and help adopters to tell their stories and ask for what they need. That's our job. So it is. There is an agenda here around stopping the cycle. When children are born with a problem that will be with them for their whole lives, it's evidence that as a society we are so far away from getting this right for these cycles of problems that go on and on and perpetuate, and getting help not just for the child but for the mother before the child is born is the only thing that's going to make any difference in the long run in this area. Once the child has fetal alcohol syndrome, then it's a question. It's the areas we were talking about before, far better support, a presumption of lifelong support available to the family.
Yeah.
Far better and more rapid assessments and diagnosis. And that's the area that we need to be in for that child and their family once they're born. But there is an agenda we haven't really talked about. And Adoption UK hasn't got a lot of experience in, but other organisations are working on it, of stopping the cycle in the first place. That is part of the conversation as well.
Well, that's very interesting, because I think you're the first sort of member of Adoption UK or CEO that I've heard who's talked about that, which is potentially controversial. Would you say it's controversial?
I think some of the solutions could be controversial, but the idea that...
You're doing yourself out of a job. Thornley.
Isn't it, as I say, it's probably an interview, you have to set it with someone else, because they, you know, there are organisations who are actively working on this and far more experience and more interesting things to say than I will. But that cycle that's driving these children coming into care is a negative and damaging one. And ultimately, that's where some of these problems will only be addressed, when some of those pressures are alleviated. Children who are born with these kinds of areas of damage.
Do you think that reflects a change in your members' views? Because I think people come to adoption as with certain views, and then living with their children and living with their children's family, because they're often present and very in their family homes in a sort of a phantom sort of way. Do you think that what you said there about that early intervention actually is something that members are really interested in, actually, that they don't want to see other children experience what sometimes their children have.
Well, I can't speak for other individuals in exactly that way. I can't put words in their mouth, but yes, I mean, it is raised with us. People are asked, adopters are asked if they would like to adopt a sibling to their own child from the birth family,
yeah,
knowing that that child could have been exposed to, you know, similar or worse problems. And that, you know, this comes up and then it's a question for them. And some of them say yes and some of them say no, but it starts to come into their lives again. Yeah. So it is of concern. It is relevant to adoptive families. And I don't have the answers. I don't have the magic wand there either. I'm really out of magic wands here, Al. Yeah, I'm writing a list of magic wands I need to be able
to put my hands really on the spot. I'm really sorry. What is the future then? So, I mean, we've talked a lot of hot topics. What's happening? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? That's terrible.
I'm going to make sure the organisation is here for adopters for the next year, 10 years, 20 years, lifetime. That's what I'm going to do.
That's a great answer.
I'm going to do that by making sure that we can continue to provide the support that we are best known for providing.
Yeah.
And that we can turn up the volume on the voices of our members and other adopters so that they are more clearly heard at the decision maker level. And I'm going to do that by hopefully appealing to more adopters to join Adoption UK. At the moment, adopters tend to come to Adoption UK when they really need support, because we can provide information and support. But I want to feel that adopters are part of the community that we represent. All adopters are, and they all have a stake in making sure that the system improves so that all adoptive families can have a brighter future, and all children that can't live with their birth parents can have a bright future. Adoption UK is working for that, and I'd love to think that more and more adopters can just support us to do that, even if they're not in a position where they themselves are in need of direct support.
That's interesting.
They may have gone through that stage.
Yeah, that's an interesting slant, because I've never sort of thought of it in those terms, but actually as a lobbying organization, then you're being paid to change things, lots of things, aren't you? Not necessarily just support me, you know, thinking as an adopter, you know, if I give my whatever pounds a year, I need, tell me how you can help me. It's more, here's some money, go and fix some things for some other people.
Yeah, and we know people want both. So hopefully we will always be there at the point of need. We'll always be there offering that peer support that was where we started and the spirit of the organisation. But we also need to be working to change the system so that it just works better for adopters and fewer of them end up in the really desperate place where they just have to reach out to other people to help them. That will always happen for some people. But the better the system gets, the more the adoptive service improves and the more we can understand adoption as a modern phenomenon, not orphan Annie, the more adopters will be contributing to that more stable future, and the less they'll be trying to paper over the cracks and shore up the crumbling defences, if we can get adoption to be a better supported system with sort of greater intelligence about the decisions that are made.
I guess one question would be, do you think that people have realistic expectations of Adoption UK and what you can and can't do?
Well, Adoption UK is a charity, and people need to remember that. So we aren't in a position of authority from the point of view of being able to make the rules. What we can do is advocate for on behalf of adopters, using the evidence from our membership and others, and make the case as well as we can for the right thing to happen. But the buck actually stops with the government or local authorities or the minister, and Adoption UK is the intermediary between the voice of adopters and that decision maker's ear. And that's what we can do. So if people think that we're going to be able to change the system single-handedly, unfortunately, we can't do that. But what we can do is bring their experiences and bring their information and make those arguments on their behalf to the right people so that they have the best chance of making the right decision.
I mean, I think that reflects perhaps my frustration with the questions that were asked. Some of them I thought, actually, you maybe misconstrued the power of Adoption UK, that actually you are a You are a you can lobby. That's all you can do. You have no decision making. Well,
we can't, and that's exactly what we do. But I mean, that's a very powerful thing. I'm a huge believer in social movements, and we represent the people who have adopted. They're the most important people in the debate about adoption. Actually, I take that back. The children are the most important people, but their families often are in position of speaking on their behalf and have their own rights and needs. So it's a tremendously privileged position that we sit in to be able to talk to people and represent them. But charities are charities, and there are limits to what we can do.
Yeah, you can only ask. You can't.
I don't want to talk us down because I do think that there is a huge authority that comes from representing adopters. But in the end, it's up to us to be as convincing as we can with the information that we've got.
Which takes you back to the very first thing about your analytical mind and ability to present evidence, kind of linked to compassionate, empathic stories. And I'm not trying to do Adoption UK down, but I just think that it's really important people have an understanding of the system, of what is actually going on here.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the time people just need to express their rage over the illogical mess that they sometimes end up in. If things are being poorly applied and decisions aren't being made well, that comes out somewhere. It can come out towards us. We can use that, as that's part of the information that we need to relay. The place where we can do more directly is in our support, peer support and delivery work, where we can set up groups where people need something. We can provide information where people need it. You know, there are some direct things we can do, but the thing that seems to enrage people the most is policy and the adoptive system. Yes. And that's where we don't get to say, but we can make the case.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, there's other questions I was going to ask, but I'm not sure you've got time. That confusion in people's minds around the difference between law and policy, and how the law isn't that specific often. It's often policy that is tripping people up on an individual authority or team or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. And so that's true. And that differs across the four countries. And then, of course, our local authorities deliver a lot of this as well. And they will have their own priorities and things that they need to work to as well. So there's multiple tiers in the adoptive system. We are embedded at all levels, and we can bring people's experiences into each of those levels of the adoptive system. I agree, it's a complex system, and it can be quite confusing, especially when adoption doesn't sit neatly within its own box. It's got a foot in mental health, and it's got a foot in physical health, it's got a foot in education, it's got a foot in this and that, and there are overlapping policy areas as well to contend with.
Yeah. And my last question, which I did forget slightly, was in relation to regional adoption agencies.
Yeah.
Good thing, bad thing, or just a thing?
It's a thing. There is a case for bringing specialists together so that they are able to work together and provide that central resource. At the moment, there's a problem with the process because the voices of voluntary agencies, which is so powerful, isn't being heard well enough in the regionalisation process. And as a result, it's becoming statutory deck chairs being reorganised. I won't say it's on the deck of the Titanic because it's not going down. But, you know, the additional value of having the voluntary agency's voice in the leadership of the regional adoption agencies needs to be secured. And that's not really there at the moment. The other thing is, of course, it's like all changes. It just creates inertia in the system. Decisions get delayed. It's more confusing. So we need to get through this phase. And if they're where they're set up, we can all begin to work out how we're going to work together again. But where agencies are still being set up, it's rather go slow. And then it's the adopters that lose out.
Yeah. So interesting days ahead.
Oh, yes, very much so.
And have you got any gossip about Scott that you could tell me?
Gossip about Scott?
Yeah. Does he wash his cup? Does he leave dirty cups on his desk?
He's got a very endearing cup, which he says his youngest gave him, "Daddy, I love you more than ice cream." But his oldest two wouldn't give that sort of thing to him anymore because they no longer are young enough to think he's as nice as ice cream. I don't know what that means in their opinion about ice cream is.
No. Oh, so there's no dirt. That's a bit boring. I'll have to dig deeper. And I have other contacts in the organisation, in your office, that I shall dig around.
Perhaps I should have been asking you for dirt on him. myself.
Noah Scott is a lovely, lovely man. He also knows where I live. But what I have noticed is Scott has, we were laughing, I've got his work mobile number and his work email. He's never given me his personal phone number. And I see him all the time. And I've realised that he actually secretly just sees me as a client or, you know, like a service user. I feel quite demoralised by that. He's just using me.
And I'm just impressed by his amazing ability to be that head of engagement that we need in that case.
Oh, now you're just saying nice things because it's your job. I can tell. So is there anything you'd like to... It's a lovely man. Is there anything you'd like to say to you that you were hoping to say or get off your chest? Or
no, I think we've had a really good conversation about all the main things. Something I want to get off my chest... Well, I don't know. I think that you've allowed me to have a really free rein to get things off my chest. The last thing I suppose I ought to say, and it goes back to some of the conversations that we were having about education, is the Adoption UK conference in November focuses on attachment and trauma in the classroom. It's going to be brilliant. We do still have, I think, a couple of weeks left on the early bird ticket, and after that people have to pay full price. And it's filling up, but there is still time. So do come if you want to have more conversations about education and adoption and attachment. It's going to be a fantastic day.
And get all the details on our website.
You will. I'll be there. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Ask you difficult questions.
Ask me those difficult questions. Yeah. Yes.
Rather than use me as some sort of, I started answering the questions on the one question. People said, "Well, why can't families just self-refer?" I said, "Well, because there's a legal. It's an act of Parliament that the local authority has a, you know, has anyway." And they weren't having it. I don't think I made any friends. But anyway. Well, let's see. We've talked for nearly an hour, so I think I should let you go because you probably have work to do, don't you?
Oh, nothing important, Al.
Nothing important. Just washing up, thinking big Absolutely. Thoughts. Excellent. Well, thank you very much for talking to me, and hopefully I'll bump into you soon and meet in person. That would be wonderful.
I would love that.
Okay. Well, look after yourself.
And thank you very much for giving me this time. It's been great talking to you.
Okay. Excellent. Well, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.